You're listening to Aspen Public Radio on this beautiful Friday evening. Coming up shortly, we have a live broadcast from the Aspen Institute. This is the Hearst Lecture Series, a conversation with Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell. Again, that's in just a moment.
Everybody in this town probably knows, which is REI. And she brings that incredible diversity of experience to her work each and every day in Washington. And so it's great to have Sally with all of that experience here tonight to talk about that. I think you'll hear that authenticity and that diversity in the conversation. The second thing I wanted to just briefly say is that in addition to all of those great attributes, Sally is also an incredibly avid climber and hiker and sailor and kayaker. And she spends as much time as she can out in the places that she's charged protecting. And one of the great things that I love about Secretary Jewell is that she is spending a tremendous amount of her time trying to ensure that the next generation of Americans also become avid climbers and hikers and kayakers and sailors, and really doing all she can through something called the 21st Century Conservation Service Corps, which she may talk a little bit about, to make sure that those folks are ready and able to learn and work in those great natural resources that this country has. So with that, let me get started. I wanted to just start with a conversation about the mission of the Department of the Interior. I don't know if everyone in this room is familiar with all that Secretary Jewell is charged with managing, but it is an incredibly broad portfolio. It is everything from the conservation side of our natural resources, places like the National Park Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, to those who are charged with managing the extraction of some of those natural resources, the Office of Surface Mining and the Bureau of Land Management. And I guess my question for you, Sally, is to just talk a little bit about how you manage that diversity of responsibility, because I think to a lot of people from the outside, that looks super ripe for internal conflict. And as somebody who's managed a bunch of large organizations, if you could talk a little bit about how you approach that.
Well, I know I'm doing a good job when everybody is mad at me. How's that? No, actually, they aren't in conflict. They don't have to be in conflict. But I will say that every agency of the Department of Interior, and there's really 10 of them, are organized under some organizing statute that was passed by Congress that helps them understand what their mission is. The mission of the Fish and Wildlife Service is really to protect our natural resources so that the fish and wildlife in our country and to a certain extent around the world don't go extinct, can continue to thrive. The mission of the Bureau of Land Management is about multiple use and sustained yield on the landscape. So what does that mean? What does multiple use mean? Well, to some people, it means all uses. To other people, it means different uses for different places. And what does sustained yield mean anyway? Does that mean we have to use these lands in a sustainable way? So all of these things are subject to interpretation and have been interpreted over time. The National Park Service, preserving these special places, America's treasures, natural treasures, cultural treasures, historic treasures, unimpaired for future generations. So what does unimpaired mean? Does that mean you can't develop a road system in Rocky Mountain National Park and pave a trail so someone in a wheelchair can have an opportunity to experience some of the beauty that those that can walk have? Well, so all of those are subject to interpretation, and that's a lot of what we do in our job, is try and get people together in a room to synchronize that. So I want a show of hands, honest show of hands, of how many of you are familiar with the greater sage-grouse. That's pretty good. You know, probably at least a third of the people in the room. Okay, so I'm just going to, if Mike will indulge me for a second. The greater sage-grouse is a bird that's native to this state, and actually now is present in 10 other states throughout the Rocky Mountains and the Great Basin. And it is a species that was recommended for listing under the Endangered Species Act. And in 2010, the Fish and Wildlife Service said, you know, a listing is warranted but precluded because we don't have the resources to deal with this long backlog of petition species for listing. It's warranted because of a lack of regulatory certainty on the future for this bird. So that launched an effort by my predecessor, Ken Salazar, and governors and the Sage-Grouse Initiative from the Western states to say, let's see if we can work together and address these challenges so that a listing is not warranted. So I have, since day one, become very familiar with the greater sage-grouse, which I had never heard of before I started my confirmation process going through the Senate in February of 2013. And I'm now, I've been out at 3 o'clock in the morning to a sage-grouse lek to watch the mating ritual. How many of you have witnessed the, oh, there's one lone hand in the back. So, yes, it's very interesting. Online, yes, online counts, okay. My point is, here you have ranchers, oil and gas companies, conservationists, fire departments, local communities, who have each have their own interests. And what has happened under the Sage-Grouse Initiative and the collective effort among 11 states is nothing short of extraordinary. So the BLM and the Forest Service are by far and away the largest landowners. Neil Kornsey, wave Neil. Neil is the director of the Bureau of Land Management. He hails from Nevada. Nevada is 87% federal lands. And so if we're going to have sage-grouse conservation in the state of Nevada, it's going to be largely on federal lands. Montana is about 30% federal lands, 70% state and private. So from Montana to Nevada and the 11 states that make up this basin, people had to come together. Oil and gas had to sit down with transmission, with real estate development, with mining interests, with conservationists, and say, what's a path forward? And the effort that's happened since 2010 is nothing short of extraordinary. The BLM has revised 98 resource management plans. They've just produced, along with the Forest Service, 15 massive environmental impact statements. Those are out for comment right now in consistency review with the governors. And we must make a determination of the Fish and Wildlife Service by the end of September on whether or not a listing is warranted. And I think what that effort says that if we work together, and I will remain optimistic that we can get to a not warranted listing, which means the states will retain control over the species and the habitat, that we will all have much smarter regulations that take into account habitat, and the things that the West is known for, the sagebrush steppe ecosystem, the 350 species that depend on that, active grazing, and ongoing development can happen in harmony because we know the areas that are too special to develop, and we know the areas that are ripe for development that really have limited conflict. So I'd say it's a long way of explaining what this job is about, but at the end of the day, in spite of the fact that I will get sued by both sides, and I'm used to that, I get like 3 lawsuits a week, so like, sue me, I'm used to it. But those are people looking out for their interests, and I understand that. But I believe because of this hard work, it will stand up to legal scrutiny, and we could have a path forward that will really change the future of conservation and change the future of how we work together, not only across federal agencies, but also across the landscapes, embracing states and private landowners and being more thoughtful about how we develop.
So that's a great story about the coalitions that are required to move these very complicated issues forward. And whether it's sage grouse or water management or drought management or trying to create a clean energy market across this country, the things that you are managing at DOI, you have often talked about how important it is that the public sector and the private sector and states and tribal governments as well come together to solve these problems. And your sage grouse example is a good one. But I guess one of the things that strikes me is that we have a lot of opportunities out there for the private sector and the public sector to be doing more collaborative work on all of those issues. And for whatever reason, it seems like we're missing the boat on a lot of those opportunities. And from where I sit, in my time in the White House, it struck me that there was just a lack of trust in a lot of those instances. I'm curious, given that you have, as I said at the top, sort of worked in all of these different sectors, what you think is misunderstood by the private sector about the public sector now, having spent a few years in it, and vice versa. And maybe something that you didn't know or you thought you knew about government before when you were at REI, but you have since learned something different.
Just one? Well, how many of you are business people in the audience? So probably close to half, sort of. I think that, you know, there's two really major differences between the private sector and the public sector that I did not understand fully until I took this job. One is budgeting. Okay, so in the private sector, you may be accused, especially if you're running a public company, of quarter-to-quarter profit focus, but I can tell you as a business person, the only non-public company I worked for was REI, which of course is a member-owned cooperative. REI members out there? Okay. Oh, yeah. More than the Sage Grouse. I figured that. We're in Aspen. But, you know, it's a member-owned cooperative. But nonetheless, you know, you have to run a business that is profitable and that is also serving its clients and balancing all the needs. And so in business, I actually was thinking on a very long-term basis. I mean, I had my first retreat with the board of directors after being named CEO was, let's talk about the trend. In fact, I said no discussions on anything that is sooner than 25 years into the future or farther out. What is going on that we know 25 years from now that we better prepare for today? So, you know, things like globalization, right? The world is getting smaller. We're getting more connected. So what does that mean for us? Things like urbanization. People are moving to cities. They're concentrating. That actually may mean good things for the environment in some ways, concentration of services, but also means how are you going to connect people to nature? How are they going to even know these places are out here that need to be protected? Demographic shifts in the population. Who's in this room? Look around. This is not reflective of the population of the United States in any dimension. We are more diverse. We are younger. Than what is generally reflected in the outdoors, certainly in the conservation community, on the boards of directors of lots of organizations that are connected to nature and the environment. So what are we going to do about that? What's REI going to do about that? What am I going to do about it now as Secretary of the Interior? Technology was another one. There were five that REI had come up with. Technology is another one, moving very quickly. How do you embrace it? Do you want people to have their devices with them in the great outdoors? What if they're taking pictures of species? I saw a head shake, but the reality is, what if they're taking pictures of species and competing with each other, like the Audubon bird list, on plant and animal identification in nature, and not only going up to a database, but feeding a biodiversity database? So all of a sudden, the technology, instead of pulling you away from nature, connecting you to nature and making you a citizen scientist. So technology's got some pretty interesting aspects, and then climate change. You know, if you're in a ski business, you better be thinking about climate change. You guys had an okay year here. Pacific Northwest, where I'm from, no snow, no ski season at all. So I'm way off topic, I'm sorry. Point is, we thought long term. I'm now in the forever business. I think it's probably fair to say that you expect me as Secretary of the Interior to be thinking about the nation's public lands and waters and assets, and frankly, upholding trust and treaty obligations to Indian tribes in this country to be forever. But I don't have a budget for, I mean, at maximum a year at a time, which has not happened as long as I've been here. At minimum, they shut you down, which happened for 3 weeks. So, you know, with parks shutting down, I scrambled to work with governors to get states to pay for reopening the national parks. I mean, crazy, crazy stuff. But what you don't know is the scientist that's been studying, and I've met a number of them, a particular species, and they need a full year's worth of data, and they just missed 3 weeks of data, which means they missed an entire year. Right? It could be the migrating sea turtles. It could be the migrating elk. It could be the migrating birds. That period of time in October, we were shut down. They lost an entire year's worth of data, and they would have been violating federal law, even on their own dime, to go and check on those gauges and other things. So we are in the forever business, and we don't even have a budget that lasts 1 year. In business, you have capital and expense. In government, it's just dollars. There is no capital budget. There's no depreciation. It's just what can you get for a budget in that year. So you want to build a building long term. It's very hard to know if you're going to have funding. And so that's crazy. Okay, so that's one. The other thing is, I told Mike I'd answer the questions short, and I'm not. I'm sorry. The other is risk. So in the private sector, you're rewarded for taking risks. There's several people here from the Energy Summit that's going on here. How many of you were at the Energy Summit? Okay, great. So, you know, I'm sure you're talking about, you know, where's energy going? Where do we invest? How's technology going to impact us? What's happening with distributed power? What's happening with renewables? You know, what's happening with conventional? Where do we place our bets? But it's all about taking risk. And there's, I'm sure, a number among you that have taken some risks, and a lot of them haven't worked, but you dust yourself off, you learn from that, and you move on, right? What happens when you take a risk in the federal government? You get called in front of Congress. Why were you wasting the taxpayer money? How could you? How could you have you know, made such a stupid decision? How could you have allowed a cyber attack to occur? Well, when you don't have a budget from a year-to-year basis, and it's very difficult to take risk. And if somebody steps out, as I would say some of my colleagues did, and said, hey, let's share some services, let's try and reduce some data centers, let's be more efficient, and it doesn't work out so well, you're called in front of a congressional hearing. That's very, very difficult. So as a leader now in government, I have to work really hard to encourage the very smart, dedicated, talented people that work in the Department of Interior to take risk, because I have to reassure them that I have their back. And I will say that the track record for having people's back is not great. So, you know, think about those things. The other thing I'd say is, you know, people will say, why isn't government more efficient? It's not really set up to be efficient. A representative democracy is not efficient. Have you seen state legislators and legislatures and congresses and city council meetings? It's not an efficient process. But it works because it brings views to the table. And so there are a lot of things that are very, very different. I'd say the most pleasant surprise, Mike, is the incredible people that we have working in public service who make a fraction of what they could make in the private sector, but they do it because they care. And they do it because they know their work has extraordinary impact. And that is harder to come by in the private sector. So. All right, I promise I'll be short.
All right, I want to pick up on your comment about thinking 25 years out. And one of the ways you're doing that is by focusing on the next generation. So you, more than I think any of your predecessors as Secretary of the Interior, have really focused on trying to get kids across this country to put down their phones and put down their iPads and everything else and to get outside. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the challenge around that. I mean, this is a generation that, you know, is known most for a short attention span. And a lot of those folks that you're trying to reach, you know, conservation or outdoors is a luxury compared to the things that they're worried about each and every day. So if you could talk a little bit about that, and then a little bit about how you, and you touched on this in your last comment, but how you build a program around getting these kids to parks and other outdoor spaces in the year and a half that you have left with, you know, the budget situation you just described and a hostile Congress and not a lot of time left.
And you left and you were helping me. Just kidding. So here's a few statistics. Kaiser Family Foundation's done some really good work in this area, and they've done longitudinal studies. So they did one in 2002, which I used to cite all the time until they updated the numbers in 2011. 2002 study, I may not get it exactly right, said that the average child in America at that time, 2002, spent 40, this is from age 6 to 18, I think, average of 47 hours of their non-school time in front of a screen of some sort. By 2011, that number had grown to 56 hours a week. 56 hours a week. So, you know, just under 8 hours, basically, a day in front of a screen of some sort. That same child, on average, is spending 30 minutes a week in unstructured outside play. So how many of you had an opportunity to play outside without an adult telling you what to do when you were a child? Okay, look around if you're in the front. Everybody raised their hand, pretty much. If somebody didn't raise their hand, I'd be shocked. That's not happening anymore. So I'm a parent, and I'm now a grandparent as well. And I looked at how I raised my children as a baby boomer, and they were much more structured than I was. And that has pretty much been true across the country. You know, they may have been involved in a lot of different activities, but they weren't playing outside. And so there is a growing lack of familiarity and comfort with the outdoors among our population. And if you combine that with urbanization and demographic shifts in the population and what the outdoors has meant for some segments of the population, they haven't felt welcome, they haven't felt safe. They're actually happy to have a roof over their head. And in some cases, for people that, you know, might have been recent immigrants and working their way up. So the way we used to do it is not working. And how do we reach an increasingly urban and increasingly diverse population of young people? And it's tricky. It's something that I worked on in my old day job at REI as well. And one of the things that we actually studied and did research on was how do people use the outdoors? And then how is the outdoors set up to meet their needs? And Latino families, we learned, whether English was the first language or the second language, use the outdoors a lot. But many times it was city parks. It was large family gatherings, groupings, a lot of interest in food and games and water. And so if you've got a campground or a park that's set up with individual picnic tables separated by trees, that's not really conducive to a group area where you'll draw families together and maybe draw families that you haven't been drawing before. So I think part of it is really listening, looking. I was with a group of Latino kids yesterday in my office. They're part of the Latino Heritage Month. They are interning at the National Park Service in historic preservation. They're all graduate students working in historic preservation and environmental sciences. So I asked them, how did you get connected to the outdoors? One had a Student Conservation Association job. One had an internship that took them into the outdoors. One had a teacher that inspired them in the fourth grade. And Mike will know where I'm going with this. This is exactly what we're doing in the Department of Interior in trying to create a continuum so kids play, learn, in my favorite classroom, the one with no walls, serve, and that is around community service and public service on public lands. Because when you get out and you work, you pull invasive species, you build trail, you pick up garbage out of a river, you never look at that place the same way. And we want to give young people that same opportunity. So the CCC by Franklin Roosevelt and my predecessor, Harold Ickes, who did an amazing job in this role back in the Great Depression, put many millions of young men, mostly 19, to work on public lands. Well, we can't do that now. The federal government's not going to sign up to pay for that. I tried to push Ken Salazar really hard with a stimulus package in 2009 when I was in my old day job. So we have leveraged the private sector. I've been out raising private money on bended knee from private companies to fund conservation corps all around the country. And I have worked with my colleagues like Neil Cornsey at the BLM. He's worked with the field office saying, who's a good organization to work with? What projects do you have that work for youth? And our goal is 100,000 young people working on public lands and 1 million volunteers a year on public lands, and we're well on our way. So that's part of it. With Mike and the president, we launched the Every Kid in a Park initiative starting this end of this summer. Every fourth grader will get a free pass to every national park and federal public land across the United States for themselves and their family, good for an entire year. Yeah. So. And no, none of you are fourth graders, so don't even try to fake it. But until I can get Congress to raise the rates, if you're 62 and over, you can, for $10, you have a lifetime pass to the national parks. It's just astounding to me. It's way too cheap. So every fourth grader. Why fourth grade? This young man yesterday, I was introduced in the fourth grade. 9, 10 years old, it's a ripe age. So we're going to get all those kids. We know how to get to them through the Department of Education, through the state school superintendents around the country. And we are working on curriculum to align it across the federal agencies so it's focused on the fourth grade. So that will give the kids the play and learn component. And in addition, we're working with cities, and we're on the way to announcing 50 cities in partnership with the YMCA and the local mayors on connecting kids in urban areas to public lands. And we're doing it, prioritizing areas where we have assets and people so that we can introduce people that way. And we will get 10 million kids in this program to play, 10 more million to learn, and pretty soon we'll get every kid in the United States in a park. So in the future, they may not look exactly like this group, but they'll all be raising their hands like you did.
Right. All right, I'm going to ask one more question, and then we're going to open it up for you all to ask questions. So get them in your head on that. I wanted to ask a question around energy. So, you know, in the 2008 campaign, there was hardly anyone, if anyone, talking about a natural gas boom in this country because many people hadn't predicted that was going to happen. And I guess my point is, in such a short period of time, we have seen a massive transformation, both domestically and what's happening around the world in terms of a really shifting energy marketplace. And I guess a few observations. One is that we have a regulatory system, both at Interior and at other agencies across the federal and state level, that are incredibly outdated to deal with that kind of massive and quick change. And so that it, oftentimes what we're doing is dealing with fast changing energy market shifts and really outdated 30 or 40 year old regulatory structures. I guess my question is, you used to be on the board of an electric utility. If you if you could put yourself back in that spot, or as you know, somebody on a public utility commission now, what kind of advice would you be giving about sort of how to make sense of these shifts and how to deal with the federal government in that process?
I'd say to an electric utility, wake up, wake up. I think that I was on the board of Avista Corporation, and I'd say it was probably more awake than a lot of utilities at the time. It was involved in fuel cells and renewables, moving away from coal, moving to natural gas, in hydro, relicensing hydro, and so on. But still all based on, you know, a grid, an old grid, not thinking as much about distributed energy, not thinking as much about technology and what technology can do for us in terms of balancing demand and load. I'm now, you know, as part of Interior, we have the Bureau of Reclamation. We've got 450-some dams under our stewardship in the Department of Interior, kind of similar to the number that are operated by the Corps of Engineers. And so we're in the water business, we're in the power business, and there are really significant changes going on. So I think that looking at where technology is taking us, looking at how we balance the load. I had the fortune of sitting next to Elon Musk at a event in Washington, D.C., as you know, at one of these fancy dinner things. And so I got a chance to talk to him about batteries and, you know, where he's going with batteries. You know, Tesla may be the first step, but what he's doing with home batteries and what that will do potentially for distributed power. And I think we still, in the general, you know, macro grid, think of our power generation coming from that source, but I think we need to be broader. Regulations, to touch on that, boy, you don't want changing regulations to be easy because you don't want them to kind of bounce all over the place. You want certainty. But boy, it is really hard to change regulations. I'm one of the few secretaries of Interior that's actually fracked wells before, because I was in the oil and gas industry 35 years ago. But it does help me understand the industry and understand the principles. I've still got friends from the industry I can call on to kind of talk about where's technology gone, which is particularly useful. in being able to go so kind of head-to-head with folks, both on the sort of I'm afraid of this side, but also on the we don't need regulation side. People expect governments to protect them in some way. They expect thoughtful regulations. And some of the best, most thoughtful regulations have to do with our environment. You know, God bless Rachel Carson in 1962 for publishing Silent Spring. That seminal work really led to the creation of the EPA under Republican President Nixon, under Bill Ruckelshaus, who was a wonderful leader. And his first act in, I think, 1972 was to ban DDT, which was because of Rachel Carson's work. But that Congress, that administration, went on to pass the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. And those two acts of regulation have made a huge difference in the air quality in Denver, Colorado, from when I lived there in 1979 through 81, when my trachea used to burn when I jogged in Denver. It's not that way as much anymore, if there's not a thermal inversion. But we've cleaned up our air a lot. So people expect thoughtful regulation. It shouldn't be easy to change. We've just updated 30-year-old fracking regulations. For people that wanted us to ban it, it actually has unlocked potential for natural gas, which, you know, is not a carbon-free fuel. It still produces carbon, but it's a lot less impactful than other fuels like coal. And it's been an important source of energy and an important source of jobs and can be done safely and responsibly, but should be regulated. Because if it's not regulated, first, people will be afraid, and second, you'll have some bad actors that won't do the right thing for the environment. But it took Neil and his group several years to do it. We are in the process of being sued by several states right now. Yesterday, we announced that we'll be releasing the stream protection rule, updates 30-year-old regulations on coal mining and its impact on water quality. There will be a lot of incoming because changing regulations is hard. Because people have a vested interest sometimes in the status quo, or they have a vested interest in a knee-jerk reaction that says we've got to stop all oil and gas, we've got to stop all coal. Well, we can't. We can't do that. Our economy would come to a halt. So what is that thoughtful balance? And David was talking a little bit about some of the discussions on regulation not keeping up with technology because I was asking him what was going on in the energy forum. And I mean, an organization like the Aspen Institute could be a convener for thoughtful discussions about how do you align the speed of technology with thoughtful regulation. The one we came out with yesterday in stream protection is designed to keep up with technology. The one Neil and his crew came out with on fracking is designed to keep up with technology. But will it? Will it work? Will it stand the legal challenges? Or by the time it gets finalized, will the industry have moved on to something new? And it's going to continue to be a challenge. But if we don't have regulation, we have the Wild West. And I think we know what that looks like. And I think we want some reasonable balance.
All right, let's open it up for questions from the audience. There are folks with mics, so if you can raise your hand, I will try to call from a diversity of folks here, right here in the row. There's a mic.
Microphone right there.
I'm George Newman. I'm the Pickens County Commissioner. And I want to start with just giving you a few little facts. Pickens County is made up of about 85% public lands. It within those public lands includes four wilderness areas. We're also a headwater community. We're the second largest Trans Mountain water diversion in the state of Colorado. And so when I think about our economy and our environment, I go back to Gaylord Nelson's great quote. Gaylord Nelson, of course, was a governor of Wisconsin and U.S. Senator and a founder of Earth Day. And he said that our economy is a wholly subsidiary of our environment, not the other way around. So my question to you, local economies in the modern West increasingly depend on the conservation of public lands. Nowhere is this more true than here in the Roaring Fork Valley. As you may know, local governments here unanimously believe drilling the Thompson Divide will harm rather than help our economy. How is the Interior Department adapting to this changing West?
Thanks for the question, and I think you've hit on what I talked about a little bit at the front end about kind of what we're doing now on the conservation of landscapes and understanding our landscapes more with regard to sage-grouse. So I do appreciate that Thompson Divide is a very special area. It's an area that I have spoken with the governor about, I've spoken with several elected officials about, and I think it's probably fair to say that the sentiment around the future of the Continental Divide has evolved over time. So we're well aware of that. The surface is generally U.S. Forest Service. The subsurface mineral estate is managed by the BLM because that's BLM has the subsurface mineral estate. The two agencies are working closely together to work with industry. I understand there are some leases for oil and gas there and some activity going on. So, you know, we want to make sure, similar to what happened with the sage-grouse, that we've got people around the table talking about what has been the future of this area and what should be the future of the area. And I think it's also fair to say that the Forest Service, which I've known through my own conservation work, has really migrated from being a largely thinking of forests as crops, it's part of, one of the reasons it's in U.S. Department of Agriculture, to thinking about the greater ecosystem benefits of forests for clean water, water filtration, you know, clean air, and so on. So the Thompson Divide is one of those areas where a lot of that comes to a head. And so, you know, I don't have specific information for you, and if you want to huddle up with Neil, who's next to you, he can probably give you a little more information. But it's on my radar, it's on the governor's radar, it's on the radar of the elected officials, and I think what we're trying to do is convene people in a room so we can find a thoughtful path forward for that region that recognizes all of those values. Thank you.
Okay, other questions? Let's go way in the back, last row.
First off, thank you so much for your work with youth and engaging in the environment. I'm a big fan. My name is Eden Barty, and I'm the executive director of a small local nonprofit called Aspen Tree. And we're working on developing a farm park model that's a way for engaging youth in public lands for sustainable agriculture. And I'm wondering if your office has done any work or research into sustainable agriculture as a method for engaging youth outdoors.
That's a great question. I will say that the USDA has done really great work in this, U.S. Department of Agriculture, including planting gardens in front of, I think, just about every USDA building, including its headquarters building in Washington, D.C., and engaging youth in those efforts. So I'm not that familiar with their programs, except that Tom Vilsack, Secretary of Agriculture, and I've talked about them, and I think it's a great way for youth to engage. I will say that as I've gone around the country and through my old job, most recent old job at REI and this one, I go to schools where they're now building raised bed gardens and engaging kids in planting gardens and working that into the science curriculum. And then, you know, that it connects kids to nature in a very localized way that then makes them more comfortable in more of a wild setting. And one of my favorite experiences was out at the Gila River Indian Community, which is a Bureau of Indian Education school in the Gila River Reservation in Arizona, which is a school that is falling apart, which is another part of my portfolio that I'm working hard on. But the kids were actually, the little kids were mixing Starbucks coffee grounds with compost in the soil and planting vegetables. The third graders were pulling the carrots that they had grown. The person, the brains behind this is actually the maintenance guy who does not have a very robust education himself, but this was his concept. And the kids are also growing native vegetables, native to their people from that region, the Tohono O'odham people. And they're doing fish farming inside. They've got hydroponics. It's quite extraordinary. So I think it's a great idea, and I would say there's a lot of work going on with USDA. And that might be a place to connect, maybe go to their website, take a look at that, and look for some inspiration. I think they may even have some grant programs around that stuff.
Okay, let's, yes, here, up in the front.
Hi, my name is Mike Pritchard. I'm the executive director for the Roaring Fork Mountain Bike Association, and I also work with IMBA, the International Mountain Bike Association. So thank you for being here, and thank you very much for your work focused on youth. I really appreciate that direction that you're taking. I do have a question for you today. There is a notion of captured agencies. It's a staple of political science, and some claim that the Interior Department has long been captured by the oil and gas industry. However, Secretary Salazar seemed to set a different tone when he revoked the oil and gas leases in Arches National Park. Is today's Interior Department prepared to reverse lower-level mistakes like Secretary Salazar did?
Yes, I think that there are a number of, you've got laws that you must uphold. That's really important. Otherwise, like, you end up in prison. Don't want to do that. But you've got laws you have to uphold, and there are valid existing rights that people paid for. And so to undo some of those things requires refunding. And, you know, that's maybe possible, maybe not, depending on the price and the amount invested and what that looks like. So it's not easy to reverse. I would say that what is more common is to have a better understanding of the landscapes and the overall value of those landscapes, which is exactly what we've done in the efforts around the greater sage-grouse. It's exactly what we're doing by using now technology to facilitate data from satellites combined with data on the ground to understand our hydrology, our plant species, our habitat, even our recreation assets, so that we can be smarter about the decisions we make going forward. So I would say that one example, when Ken Salazar took over the Department of the Interior, the offshore oil and gas leasing had been done on an area-wide leasing basis, which basically said the prior administration said, y'all come, lease what you want, okay? There were no restrictions. What he started, and I have continued and even refined further, is let's target the areas. Where is the high potential? What are the safety ramifications? Where is the infrastructure? What are the ecological benefits? So, for example, President Obama basically withdrew Bristol Bay in Alaska from mineral activities, withdrew the Hannah Shoal, withdrew the Barrows Canyon. Thank you. So we said these are areas that should never be leased. They were wide open and available for leasing. There are some valid existing leases on the edge of a few of them, but for the most part, they are now off limits for at least 20 years. Ken Salazar withdrew lands for mining around the Grand Canyon. You know, those are things that we're always looking at. And, you know, it's not something that should be taken lightly. You are all using minerals today, I guarantee it, because you all have a cell phone, right? You know, we are all users of some of these products that we'd rather not have mined in our backyards, but we still don't want to give up these things that we need. So how do we have thoughtful development? And so I'd say, yeah, there's some mistakes made, and you might try and undo those mistakes. It might cost some money to undo those mistakes, or you might have a negotiation with the company saying, you know, gosh, this looks like a mistake, and you're probably going to get tied up in court with others for a long time, so maybe we can work on some kind of a deal here. And that sort of thing is absolutely going on all the time, including, you know, home sites that are right in the middle of spectacular national parks, right, that we'd love to acquire. If we could just get the Land and Water Conservation Fund reauthorized by Congress and a little more money for it, we could get those happen. So anyway, much more thoughtful approach, and I think that that will set a bar that I hope all of our successors will follow.
Up here in the front.
Mike, Secretary Jewell, thank you very much for being here. I'm Kirk Johnson. I work with Rural Electric Co-ops in Washington, D.C., and so I've got a comment and then a question that has nothing to do with your current job. But your focus on national parks, I think it might be really interesting to partner up potentially between the co-ops and the Park Service to do some work together. We have a very vibrant rural youth program to try to help keep some of those kids in rural America, keep it vibrant. So it might be something worth exploring, and I might want to follow up with you and your staff on that. My question for you is more on your past job. As a co-op guy, I'm always interested in people who have that experience, and having a person in high level of government who knows what a co-op is great. Could you give a 2-minute public service announcement about the co-op business model and how a consumer-owned entity like that is beneficial?
That's good. Well, here's my 2-minute. I obviously don't do anything in 2 minutes, but I'll try and keep it to that. When you're in a public company, I'd say you have 4 legs to the stool. Got your customers, you've got your shareholders, you've got your employees, and you've got your community, right? And sometimes the shareholder leg kind of gets a little bigger than the other legs, and we've seen that happen. You know, employees might suffer, community might suffer, customer might suffer. We've all been through that. We've all been through that just with the airlines, right? A co-op, your customer and your shareholder are one and the same. So you have a 3-legged stool, but it's easier to keep in balance if 2 of those legs are the same. So it's really employees, customers, and community. And I think that enables you to align the values of those. So it's not a profit motive in the same way. You have to run a sustainable business. You have to make a profit to be able to invest in the future, and you have to run a smart business. And, you know, I think the risk is the employee leg of the stool gets too big because the shareholders probably aren't watching. Those co-op members may not be watching. So you have to watch that. But it's actually a great model because you can think longer term, and you can align the values of your organization with the interests of your customers. So that's my co-op announcement. I will say, rural electric co-ops may be close to national parks. They also probably close to BLM lands, and we would welcome the opportunity, and Forest Service lands. We're all in this together, trying to engage more youth in our work. So I would say if for your rural electric, it's kind of an oxymoron. He's in Washington, D.C. representing rural electric co-ops. And he's using Pepco like I am, and not always reliable. Like, I didn't have gas this morning. I had to go to the gym to shower. That's all right. Never mind. But I would say your co-op should be, I think, would find a welcome, receptive audience from the public land manager close by. BLM manager, state director, park service superintendent, forest service supervisor, and we'd love to follow up on that. Thanks.
Okay, let's see if we can get a few more in here. On the aisle right here.
Madam Secretary, thank you so much for being here. My name is Rachel Richards. I'm a Picken County Commissioner as well. And I'd like to let you know that I just got back from North Carolina with the National Association of Counties meeting. I'm a member of their Public Land Steering Committee. And myself and a commissioner from Ouray County submitted a resolution supporting the reauthorization of the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And it was accepted with a minor amendment by that group. We also passed a resolution supporting full funding for the National Parks Association, Park Service, as well as one to support the reauthorization of the FLIRA fee service program. So we greatly appreciate our partners in the Forest Service and the BLM. My question is, the United States Forest Service recently issued a draft record of decision closing the majority of the Thompson Divide area to future oil and gas leasing. Their decision specifically noted the near-unanimous local government and community public support for conserving the Thompson Divide area. This decision was a clear indication that overwhelming public support can and should carry significant weight under the National Environmental Policy Act. Can you assure us that your department will also consider local concerns as it analyzes illegally issued leases in the Thompson Divide area?
I can't say the premise on whether leases were illegal or not because I don't know enough about that, but I can reassure you that we absolutely will take community input into account, no question about it. And I will also say that, you know, this is the other surprise. I never really understood the phrase all politics is local or local. I really understand that. And I'm going to understand it even more later on today because I'm going to Glenwood Springs to meet with a bunch of other county commissioners from a number of other counties when we're done. But local input is critical. Local voices matter. IMBA, International Mountain Biking Association, powerful, powerful voice and strong volunteer organization for responsible mountain biking on public lands, because when mountain bikes were first sold by REI and others, the uses were not always responsible and the conflicts were really dramatic. And we have a difference there because of a thoughtful nonprofit organization that said, let's get our arms around this and do it right. The same is true for county commissioners, nonprofit organizations, local business people getting together. This is what's, you know, been so extraordinary for me around the sage-grouse. I mean, where the BLM would have been in its plans, or the Forest Service, where we would have been in the Fish and Wildlife Service, is very different than where we are today because of the input from ranchers, cattlemen's associations, nonprofit organizations, county commissioners, rural fire protection associations, governors. I mean, it really does matter. So we do listen and we adjust our plans. So I can certainly reassure you we will do that in this case as well.
Okay, let's do one more up here.
You're making those
runners. Sorry, mic runners.
It's good for him. It's only 8,800 feet.
I'm Miranda Ballantyne. I'm the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Installations, Environment, and Energy. I also am a former resident of Pickens County in Aspen, so glad to be here in this forum with you. One stakeholder you didn't mention when you were talking about the sage-grouse was the Department of Defense. I wonder if you could talk a little bit to this audience about the important role that the Department of Defense plays in federal lands, in protection of our environmental infrastructure, in protection of conservation and endangered species.
Absolutely. Thank you for the question, and I'm sorry I didn't mention it. Probably take it for granted is the short answer to that, because Department of Defense has a lot of land, and in fact, Department of Defense uses a lot of land that is otherwise BLM land or Fish and Wildlife Service land, and you know, we have a tremendous cooperative relationship. They actually, in the Department of Defense, just to make sure that our nation's defenses are strong, have the ability to roll us if they want to on the Endangered Species Act and probably just about anything else, but they don't. They don't choose to do that. They work with us. And it's kind of interesting. We've had, President, just last week, named three new national monuments, which is very exciting. Yeah. And I will say that one of the other new national monuments named in February, I'm going to go enjoy tomorrow, which is Browns Canyon, which is why I'm out here. The Basin and Range National Monument in Nevada has for years been a critical training area, I think for the Air Force, maybe other branches as well. And Department of Defense has been a very good steward of the lands. When we've expressed concerns about species, they've responded. Sometimes when you have, firing ranges like we had at Fort Ord, you've also got areas where human beings weren't allowed, and so the habitat's reasonably intact, save a little bit of unexploded ordnance, which keeps people out. VA case, it's the habitat's pretty good, not so good for people. But I think that it's fair to say that they've been strong partners, and we hope that that will continue in every dimension. So thanks for raising that.
All right, we only have a few more minutes, and I just want to close with my own question here, actually. So you came to Washington a few years ago in the midst of sort of an unending parade of negative rhetoric about what was broken in Washington, what's bad about government, what's not working. And I know from our conversations that, and your ability to get outside of Washington, that you've been able to see a lot that really is working, sort of not making headlines, but even in DC and in places around this country. And I'm just curious, what about what you've seen do you feel is sort of the most entrepreneurial or gives you the most hope as you look down past the time that you'll be Secretary?
Well, I'd say in spite of the comments I made earlier about risk-taking and the lack of motivation for people to take risks, we still have people taking really important risks. And people that really understand technology and are saying, how do we use that to do our jobs even better? So one of the areas of tremendous entrepreneurship I see is in the use, the intersection between, and I did talk about this a little bit earlier, but the intersection between the landscape work on the ground and correlating that with what we see from space and what we see in all the various data sets that we have. The president has been very focused on open data. The U.S. Geological Survey, which is also in the Department of Interior, has massive amounts of data that is incredibly rich. I mean, who knew that you could now look at the amount of groundwater in an aquifer from space? But we can. How do they do that? Well, it turns out it's called a gravitometer, and basically they're measuring slight changes in the Earth's gravitational pull depending on the amount of water that's in those groundwater reservoirs. But you can correlate that with what you're seeing on the ground in the well data and in the water flow data. And there are some really smart people that are pulling this together. And they're doing it with organizations like ESRI, phenomenal mapping capabilities. You know, the ability now for Neil Cornsey and I to sit down and kind of look at maps, or even be, as I was just a few weeks ago, right kind of on the front line. I was in Reno for the Western Governors Association, mostly for my pilgrimage on behalf of the sage grouse. But there was a very significant fire going on close by. So the governor and I went out to the fire coordinating center and out to where basically the road closure was for the fire. And the maps they were using now show critical sage grouse habitat. And so they know where the fire is, they know where the sage grouse habitat is, they know where the communities are. Obviously, you're going to protect human life and property first and firefighter safety. But now we're looking at old growth forests of sagebrush, not just old growth forests of trees, which are also important. We understand that because of the intersection of technology and science and our ability to use it. So I'd say we've got some very, very exciting things going on in interior and in land management that, you know, there are a lot of entrepreneurs working in the organization in spite of all the things that are conspiring to make them not be entrepreneurial. So, and really, really good people that dedicate themselves to this work, because while it might not pay well and you might not get a raise for years and you might have a 3-week unplanned vacation that you could be called back from any time that you may or may not get paid for, you come to work every day because you can make a difference, not just for this generation, but for generations to come. So that's that helps fuel the fire, I think, of many of the people I work around. I'll also say I'm not going to be able to stand around and meet and greet because I do have to run off to Glenwood Springs to meet with a group of county commissioners. But I really appreciate the attentiveness of this audience and your interest in these things, and just a few questions you've asked give me a sense that we've got a lot of kindred spirits out there that care about these special places and want to do right by them, but also recognize the world is a complicated place.
So thank you all for your participation.